This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Even members of President Trump's own party don't much like his budget. Congressman Rodney Davis is especially opposed to cuts in agriculture spending.
Well, it's devastating, which is why we're going to stand up and fight it.
The Taylorville Republican says budgets are visions from presidents not meant to be taken literally. Charlie Schlenker has the interview. The state legislative session is over, and observers are left with more questions than answers. You'll get analysis during an IPR politics roundtable. And it's the classic country of the cactus blossoms. They're playing the Castle Theater tonight. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's June 5th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. President Trump's proposed budget has aroused dismay in a variety of sectors, including agriculture. The Illinois Farm Bureau and other ag groups have protested the deep cuts to crop security programs, SNAP, formerly known as food stamps, and foreign food aid. And GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with Republican Congressman Rodney Davis about the Trump spending plan. Davis says farmers don't need to worry just yet.
Oh, it's devastating, which is why we're going to stand up and fight it. President's budgets, though, remember, are visions documents. I've spent 4 years in Washington, D.C., and I saw four budgets from the Obama administration. And we would see those bills come to the floor for a vote. And I can't remember a single Democrat voting for any of those budgets that the Obama administration put forth. And President Trump's budget is going to get the same reaction. Presidents propose these vision documents, and then we go through our appropriations process and we set what the priorities are. It's just like we did with the president throughout and his administration throughout ideas for the omnibus bill that we voted for a few months ago that funded government through September 30th of this year, the end of the fiscal year. And a lot of the priorities were not the priorities that we put together in a bipartisan way. Priorities like plussing up Head Start by $100 million, making sure we plussed up the NIH and NIH research. We actually instituted year-round Pell Grant usage, so those who qualify for Pell Grants, those who need help the most getting that college education, can take classes over the summers and get out of school faster and thus have less debt. That was all part of the bipartisan agreement that we put together just 2 months ago, just for this fiscal year. That's the same process we're going to use to make sure that we fund government for FY18, regardless of what the president submits in a budget proposal.
Why should any president do a visioning document like that?
Well, I think it was good that the president proposed a budget for the first time in my career that actually balances. Now, I disagree with the president and his budget director, my former colleague Mick Mulvaney, on some of the priorities that they put forth and some of the cuts that they put forth. But that's what Congress and the legislative process is all about. It's about working together to come up with a principled compromise, just like we did for the FY17 spending bill just a few short months ago, and we'll do the same for FY18.
The president's visioning document or budget would cut Medicaid by 50% by 2027, non-defense discretionary funding by 41.5% by 2027. Medicare and Social Security largely left unchanged, and everything else gets cut. Speaking broadly, what's your vision?
Well, obviously, we have a different approach to how to solve our nation's fiscal problems. The president is living up to a promise that he made not to go into the mandatory spending programs that you just mentioned. 66% of our budget. Remember, I want to explain the difference between the federal budget and the state budget. The state budget, when you talk about a budget, that means money's appropriated too. Our budgets that we talk about in Washington, again, our vision documents, our appropriations process is what actually puts the money into the different categories. And that's what we're going to debate. But when you talk about an overall overarching aspect of our country's fiscal health. You cannot shy away from looking at the impact of mandatory spending programs and how do we make them work better. Right now, we could shut the government down tomorrow and say we're spending nothing. And still, the Department of Treasury, by law, because of mandatory spending, will print 66% of all the federal expenditures. And those expenditures are continuing to grow and eating up discretionary spending. And this budget document is what you get when we don't have individuals of both parties that are willing to take on some tough decisions to change the fiscal trajectory of our country for my generation and for future generations. And when anyone talks about an idea like this, people will use scare tactics to scare seniors into thinking they're going to lose their Social Security and Medicare. I stand here today and always will stand here today to tell you that is never going to happen unless in year 2032, we don't have enough people in Washington that are willing to make the tough decisions for my generation as a 47-year-old and for the next generation to ensure that those programs exist when that generation is ready to retire.
We've been talking about it for 15 years already, and nobody has made those choices.
And that is a very frustrating process for me as a member of Congress, because we're not going to be able to tackle the debt that continues to grow unless we tackle the mandatory side of our ledger. And when I've had a chance to do that, we've actually had successes. I helped write the 2014 Farm Bill. And in that bill, the Congressional Budget Office estimated, because of our changes in policies, our cuts, we cut $23 billion in mandatory spending. 80% of those cuts were on the ag policy side versus 20% to the food and nutrition program, the SNAP side, even though 80% of the farm bill is SNAP and 20% is ag. After 3 years, the Congressional Budget Office has come out and said they were wrong. They realized we actually, because of policy changes we made, changing words on pieces of paper in Washington, D.C., we've saved the American taxpayers $104 billion. That's a pretty substantial error coming out of the Congressional Budget Office just on ag policy. So we're doing our job in the areas that I can have an immediate impact on, but we've got to have politicians from both parties be willing to stand up and make some of the tough decisions. But unfortunately, that hasn't happened yet.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. That was Congressman Rodney Davis of Taylorville. He spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlinker. Ahead during Sound Ideas, a few answers to the lingering questions after the state legislative session adjourned for the second year without a budget. That's still to come during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Over the next few days, you'll hear from a Midwestern perspective on a federal program called Veterans Choice. It was designed to improve wait times for veterans seeking medical care. Today, IPR's Jenna Dooley introduces you to some of the program's pitfalls, first from a group of veterans who gathered recently in Northern Illinois.
It's been an amazing improvement for the health and well-being of these veterans.
It was the fastest time I've ever got a prescription, period.
When it first came out, it was kind of a disaster because the VA leaped into this program without doing a heck of a lot of research and getting their ducks in a row.
The VA is in a mess, and I don't know how you dig that mess out, but privatization or veterans' choice will help alleviate maybe the backlog.
We need to have the confidence that we're not going to get stuck with the bill.
So you get the whole gamut from absolutely great to worst thing you could ever come up with. And so that means it's broken somehow. Something's not right.
Let's start with the basics of Veterans Choice. It was established in 2014 to speed up the time it took veterans to get care. It came in the form of a $16 billion influx to the Department of Veterans Affairs. Quill Lawrence from NPR has been following the money. And Quill, how was that money spent?
There was a breakdown there of about $10 billion going to most to what most people think of as the Choice program, which was $10 billion to get vets appointments outside the VA system. And that the idea behind that was that for a short time, they would let vets go outside the system to just take the pressure off the overloaded VA medical centers and the overbooked VA doctors. There was also, most significantly besides that, $2.5 billion for hiring new doctors and nurses across the VA system. And that's most of the money that NPR followed up.
So the goal was to reduce wait times. Is there evidence that this money accomplished that?
Well, the bottom line is that wait times did not improve. So if you ask the VA, they'll say, well, we saw a lot more people through choice. They are still using outside the system doctors to see at this point almost a third of their patients, but they're receiving an overwhelming demand from both new veterans coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan with more complicated injuries, and also a demographic bulge of Vietnam and older veterans who are reaching the age where they need more medical care than they ever have before in their lives, and they're turning to the VA for that.
You saw this kind of workaround mentality?
This was a system they set up in a rush. Congress gave them 90 days to set it up. What came out was something that veterans couldn't understand very well. It hadn't been explained well to them. It was something that the doctors they were going to see outside the VA system couldn't understand very well, wasn't explained to them. The third-party administrators that the VA hired to do this were very confusing for everyone to use. They didn't seem to understand the program very well. And the VA itself did not seem to understand the program very well. It was the sort of thing when you're investigating a story that you keep on getting official people who should know saying, well, we think it's working this way. Hundreds and hundreds of people ended up getting stuck with bills and their credit rating would get crushed. So the VA eventually actually set up a hotline to help people repair their credit rating because they had gotten caught up in the sort of bounce check feedback loop of Veterans Choice.
And the Veterans Choice program being extended, does this extension include any tweaks designed to improve care and wait times?
The extension, I think people might be confused to think of this as the government saying, we think this is working great, we're going to renew it. That's not what it is. What happened is that the Vets Choice program is set to expire in August, which means, for example, if you have a long medical procedure that would be starting now and you'd be getting treatments over the course of a year, for example. Right now, they can't authorize that because the program, the money, was going to run out in August. So what they passed recently was just a stopgap funding measure to keep the people who are using Choice now going so they can keep getting treatment. Everyone has said for over a year now on both sides of the political aisle and at the VA that they want to reform this comprehensively.
One member of Congress trying to resolve that is Tammy Duckworth, a U.S. senator from Illinois. She's an Iraq War veteran and former director of the Illinois Department of Veterans Affairs. She goes to the Hines VA facility for health care, but also used the Choice program for obstetrics services.
I voted for the Choice program, but it's been very poorly executed, and I'm here now in the Senate working to try to fix the way the bureaucracy was set up around how to implement Choice so that it truly makes it easier for veterans, not harder.
Tomorrow on Sound Ideas, you'll hear more from veterans as they navigate their healthcare options. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Batal Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. As Connect Transit wrestles with possible route cuts to meet its newly approved budget, the system is also dealing with the elimination of a transfer center at Eastland Mall. WGLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with Connect Transit Interim General Manager Isaac Thorne about why the mall will have only a bus stop instead of a transfer center.
Yeah, so the mall is doing expansive redevelopment at Macy's. They're also remodeling some restrooms there. So we're going to move out to Eastland Drive. They're installing a concrete bus shelter pad for us, and then we're going to install a shelter there. So instead of it being a transfer center, it's going to be basically a bus stop for our buses. And we have basically redesigned some of our routes to be able to serve Eastland Drive instead of the East Lamoille Transfer Center.
How does that affect traffic, your current carriage of passengers? Where are they getting on and off?
Yep. So obviously right now they're getting on and off at the East Lamoille Transfer Center behind Kohl's there, JCPenney's. So what they're going to have to do now is people getting off at the mall can get off on Eastland Drive, but people going the opposite direction on Eastland Drive have to walk across the street to walk inside the Bergner's store. So it's going to create some issues for some of those passengers getting off on the opposite side of the street.
How should they solve that?
What we're trying to do is work with Eastland Mall during this development situation and basically try to get in there and find somewhere where we can actually put in some infrastructure, some more shelters, maybe a concrete structure where we can have buses staged there, dropping off passengers, picking up transfers. We go back to making an actual transfer station instead of just a transfer point.
How many passengers are we talking about in any given day or week, whatever your metric is?
Yep, our average daily passengers there are 150. During the winter months, it's around 250 passengers. So typically around Christmas time, 250 passengers. The rest of the average is 150 a day.
Up or down during the school year then for students?
It stays pretty flat around 150 on average. People were dropping off, picking up there.
Okay. Is that worth a full transfer station then?
I think if we put in a transfer station, we're actually going to attract more people. And it all depends on what development happens at the mall. Obviously, there's a lot of stores that have closed down there. The Macy's has left. So it just depends on what comes there, because a lot of people were dropping off at the mall. Obviously, they're going there to spend money or to earn money. So a lot of the passengers were dropping off for doing those two things. So it just depends on what stores come to the mall. And I think it probably could be 250 on a daily basis if they had that kind of development.
Much has been made about the future of malls in the U.S. and the different kinds of malls, lifestyle centers as opposed to traditional covered malls. Mm-hmm. How does transit experience the difference between those two kinds of facilities?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're putting in apartments at a mall, obviously that changes everything. It's kind of more of a mixed use that you see in Main Street of America. If you change it to mixed use where you're having people live there and there's also stores in there as well, you're going to have a whole lot more traffic, a lot more people getting on and off the bus, because then they may not own cars, they may not want to have a car, or maybe they just choose to take transit. But it does change the dynamic.
Isaac Thorne is the interim general manager of Connect Transit. He spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. There are two public engagement sessions scheduled this week. Tonight, Connect Transit staff will listen to customers and anyone who wants to share an opinion about route reductions. The session is at the Bloomington Public Library from 5 to 6 p.m. In the interest of full disclosure, I'm a member of the Connect Transit Board of Trustees. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is Sound Ideas on GLT. Coming up, a preview of tonight's show at the Castle Theater. You'll hear from the opening act, The Cactus Blossoms. That's on the way during Sound Ideas. Another end of a spring legislative session in Illinois, and another instance where observers are left with more questions than answers, and certainly left without a state budget. Sean Crawford moderates the Illinois Public Politics Roundtable with panelist Charlie Wheeler, the head of the Public Affairs Program at the University of Illinois at Springfield, IPR State House reporter Brian Mackey, and reporter Douglas Fink of the State Journal Register newspaper. Fink agrees the lack of a state budget is the new normal.
Pretty much, and it's kind of what your definition of news is. If it's something out of the ordinary, then this doesn't count as news anymore because it's a standard practice. The fact of the matter is there are a lot of factors that led to this. The House Democrats had some issues with the components of the tax hike bill that came over from the Senate. They also had some concerns about the level of cuts that were in the spending plan. So at best, what the Senate sent over was going to be tweaked by the House, and then it was going to have to go back to the Senate for their approval. But really the biggest factor in this was that the governor announced that he would flatly veto this thing if it got to his desk. And why in the world would any Democrat want to put their vote on a tax hike bill knowing the thing would never become law anyway, because the House Democrats don't have enough votes to override a veto? So with that threat looming, there was no reason to act at this point.
And Brian, I don't want to say it's all the governor's fault, but that certainly seemed to be the trigger that took these negotiations in a different down a different path. And at the end of the day, here we are without a budget again.
Yeah, we heard from Senate President John Cullerton saying, the Democratic take is we passed the governor's ideas. The governor wanted to change the purchasing and procurement rules in the state of Illinois. We put a bill on his desk to do that. The governor wanted to change the school funding formula. He had a commission to do that. We drafted their ideas into bill form, voted on it, and passed that. They didn't actually send that to his desk. We can get into that later for parliamentary reasons. But, Cullerton says, the governor asked us to do these things. We did them. Did we do every little detail of how he wanted them done? No. But the governor has, repeatedly said it's not good enough for, the reform he thinks Illinois needs, for what the changes he wants to make. And he, after the Senate Democrats voted for a budget with tax increases, the state Republican Party went after them. There were robocalls and ads and that sort of thing. And they even started targeting House Democrats in anticipation of that. And that, what we heard at the top of the show, scared some Democrats. They don't want to vote for something that the governor is going to use to bludgeon them over the head with. And so I guess in this case, the governor's right about one thing. The status quo is easier to maintain than changing anything. And as Doug was saying, the new normal, whether it's news or not, to not have a budget is the status quo. And it was easier to just kind of let that situation roll along than to do something bold or courageous and actually, vote one way or the other.
Well, I guess the fact that the legislature, the Democrats, did agree to at least meet the governor part of the way on some of these issues, that should give us hope, I would guess, that maybe they can, work these differences out and something can get done. But yet I don't seem to feel a lot of hope among our panel today. Maybe you guys feel a little differently on that.
I don't have a lot of hope about it because I'm not convinced that anyone is willing to do everything that needs to be done, right? For the governor, it would be, he often uses this phrase, I will go along with tax hikes. He does everything he can to not sort of take ownership of tax increases, even though basically, if you listen to his statements and parse what he says, he acknowledges that you cannot not only balance our current budget, which is $7 to $8 billion out of balance this year, but meet our long-term liabilities, such as the $14.5 billion in overdue bills we owe, and the $130 billion in pension liability. So, is the governor sincere about, putting his name and his signature on a tax hike, even as he's telling constituents, you deserve to not have a tax hike, you deserve to be protected from a tax hike? And then are the Democrats, and well, we know John Cullerton is, but is Speaker Madigan willing to give Rauner a win on any of these issues? Or is he just kind of holding his breath and waiting for January 2019 when in presumably Speaker Madigan's hopes, somebody other than Bruce Rauner will be raising his hand to take the oath of office as governor of Illinois?
And Doug, you're never cynical about state government, I know. So your thought is this is going to keep going as well for the foreseeable future?
I would think so. There's a great deal of distrust on both sides right now, and there's no sign of that easing up. You heard it in Madigan's statement at the top of the show where he said the Democrats have concerns with the way the governor is handling this situation. There's a widespread belief on the part of the Democrats that no matter what they agree to, the governor is going to either demand more or say that what they, as he has with some of these things, that it doesn't go far enough, so it's unacceptable. And unless the two sides start trusting each other more and are more amenable to compromise, no, it's not going to end.
Charlie, you have covered state government for a long time. You've seen people who don't like each other, who maybe don't get along, who just have maybe even some minor differences. In the end, they're able to get something done. They're able to work together. And that doesn't seem to be happening here. As you look ahead, do you see any evidence that these guys can sit down and get something put together?
I think Doug hit at it when he said there's a lack of trust. And to me, a lot of that falls on the governor's shoulders. If he were serious about getting a deal, he wouldn't have his minions in the Republican Party organization, which he's, you know, he bought it, he paid for it, and he has the right to tell them what to do. But if he were serious, he wouldn't be sending out robocalls. He wouldn't be putting stuff online. He wouldn't be having cable TV ads blasting Democrats for raising taxes or for thinking about raising taxes when he himself has admitted we need more revenue. So if I'm serious about negotiating with Doug, I don't go out of my way to badmouth Doug and to talk about him behind his back. I may decide I don't like Doug, which obviously is not the case. We're good friends for many, many years. But you don't go into a negotiation, I wouldn't think, and at the same time be trying to poison the well. And that's maybe the difference. Yeah, there have been a lot of people over the years who didn't get along very well and who differed greatly in their political views. But in the past, they were always able to compromise. And it's funny because Jim Durkin, the House Republican leader, was talking about how Democrats for 20 years have been running the state into the ground. I'm paraphrasing here. And I'm thinking to myself, 20 years, this is 2017, 20 years ago, that was 97. Oh, that was Jim Edgar was the governor. Oh, that was Pate Phillip was the president of the Senate. Democrats didn't get control of everything until 2003. So Representative Durkin is weak either in math or in history. But that's the kind of narrative that goes out, and folks who don't pay as close attention to this stuff as we do fall for that nonsense.
Well, here's something that doesn't really make a lot of sense to me, and that is if I'm a supporter of the Democratic Party, maybe I'm hoping that there's money for social services, higher education, other things that are there. I would still want to see the Democrats put a budget on the governor's desk and force the governor's hand in some way. They didn't do that. Is that a mistake?
I don't know if you were asking Charlie that, but I'm going to jump in
since
he didn't and say that I'm very curious about that very point, because I almost think that, you know, the Tribune had a headline this week, which was something along the lines of how the governor kept a tax increase from landing on his desk. And I thought that was a very interesting and insightful way to put it, because in a way, the governor doesn't have to be the one who says, who, you know, the buck stops here. The governor can say, this is the House Democrats, or as his message consultants told him to say this week, the majority party. He would not say Democrats. He just kept saying majority party, interestingly, but that's I digress. But, you know, now the governor doesn't, the buck doesn't stop on his desk. He can blame the Democrats in the House for not passing a budget. So when we had the two credit rating agencies downgrade state government this week, he can blame the Democrats. I'm very curious to see what would have happened if House Democrats would have put that on his desk, and then maybe he would veto it. Maybe he wouldn't. Maybe he would try to do some sort of a mandatory veto to lessen the impact on taxpayers or something like that. And if he did veto it and it comes back to the House, we know the Senate probably has enough votes to override. The Democrats have supermajorities there. What would have happened in the House? Would you, at that point, this is the best hope Illinois would have had for an actual budget in 2 years, could you have tried to peel off a couple of Republicans at that point who have universities at their districts, in their districts, who have state prisons and other, you know, whose local economies depend on state government more than other parts of the state? That's a question we don't have an answer to right now, and probably won't, because at this point, the Democrats can no longer pass a budget without Republican votes because of the vote threshold change that happened on June 1st.
And, Doug, this gets back to the conspiracy theorists who think that Speaker Madigan doesn't want to see a budget done. He wants to see Rauner have to go into reelection without ever getting a budget, approved, a full budget in the state of Illinois during his term. It certainly seems to go along with that concern that a lot of people have.
Well, that's one concern. I think you also have to weigh that. Does the how badly do the Republicans want a budget done? Because their entire theme that they've been developing is that Madigan is the cause of all this stuff, and the Democrats follow Madigan, so they're the evildoers here. And Is that their strategy for holding out until 2018 in the hopes of picking up additional seats and perhaps even control of one of the chambers?
Charlie, where could this go next? We just mentioned the fact there's not a lot of trust out there. Is it just basically that we sit here and say, well, Madigan and Rauner, they can't get along, nobody trusts each other? Is there still a possibility that the rank and file, which it seemed to be happening earlier in the year, could move this ball forward?
Yeah, that's what I've said all along. It's going to take the rank and file. It's going to take Republicans who are willing to stand up to Rauner and say, look, for the sake of my district, I'm going to have to vote for something, for the human services in my district, for the school kids in my district, the universities. I have to vote for something. And similarly, rank and file members in the Democratic caucus will be telling the speaker, we have to do something. And I think the pressure is probably greater on Madigan than it is on Rauner. You know, Rauner lives in a world where none of this stuff affects him. He says, you know, the right stuff about, oh, I feel your pain and 100% and all that kind of nonsense. But he's still holding to this non-budget agenda, property tax freeze, for example, which has nothing to do with funding state government because, as I've said before many times in many venues, the property tax all pays for local government, chiefly schools. So anyway, I think you need the little people, so to speak, in the General Assembly, the rank and file members, the backbenchers, what used to be called the Mushroom Caucus because they were kept in the dark and fed horse manure. You need them to go to their leadership and say, look, for the sake of my constituents, let's get a budget in place. Now, the danger, I would think, for the Democrats is we send a budget to the governor. He vetoes out everything except K-12 education, and we limp along while he continues to push his non-economic agenda.
Brian and Doug, can you talk about the fallout from not getting this budget? We've already seen, I believe, Brian, you reported credit downgrades since the adjournment, the end of the session, at least, on Wednesday that took place. So we're already seeing some impact. What's the other fallout we're expected to see over the next few months?
Well, you mentioned the credit rating downgrades. We also saw this week that Northeastern Illinois University, which had closed several days during its spring semester, announced 180 people were being laid off. There's a union-backed group out there that's opposed to Rauner that did
SIU is also laying some people off.
I was going to say there's a union-backed group that said overall they've tallied 1,500 public university layoffs that they lay at the feet of the budget impasse. I think we're going to continue to see human service organizations. There was a heartbreaking story, I think, out of the Peoria Journal Star this week or last week, I lose track, about a social service organization that takes care of kids who have pretty severe mental health problems and, you know, can be suicidal or have just terrible problems. And that one is closing because the state is not paying, and when it does pay, it's so far behind that it's just not sustainable. We've seen drug treatment centers close. There's a real human toll for the people who are who need help because of mental health problems, as I said, or addiction or other things like that. And those stories are going to continue happening without state funding.
And Doug and Brian, I don't want to be flippant about that, but at the same time, we've been seeing a lot of this. We've seen the layoffs. We've heard about the social services. That hasn't seemed to move anybody off the dime. Will it do it this time?
Being cynical about it, I'd have to say, why would you think it's going to be different now? The toll has been mounting for 2 years now, and it hasn't moved anybody yet.
I will say, I mean, the toll is not, it's been mounting. People have not been as willing to sort of express it in some cases, though. We've seen this particularly with universities because they don't want to damage their recruiting prospects. So they kind of try and say, well, we're managing, we're doing okay. And, you know, at the U of I, which employs all of us on this panel except for Doug, that is true more than other places because they have a lot of other revenue sources other than state aid. But for some of the universities that are more dependent on that, they've been kind of papering over some of these problems. And so maybe there isn't as much. Well, we know from polling that there isn't as much public awareness of this. And I would add, if some of the vendors that have been through their good graces keeping the state of Illinois going, if MJ Kellner, which supplies a lot of food to prisons, decides that, you know what, this is just not worth it for us anymore and decides to cut the state of Illinois off. I mean, I don't know. Maybe Doug's right. Maybe even a prison riot would not, you know, garner sympathy in some of the wealthier parts of the state. I'm just not sure anymore, if, as Doug said. You know, anything that's bad that happens now, both sides can point at the other guy and say it's the big bad governor's fault, it's the big bad speaker's fault, and just dig in further into their positions.
Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield. Joining him on the Illinois Politics Roundtable was Doug Finke of the State Journal Register, IPR Statehouse reporter Brian Mackey, and moderator Sean Crawford. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, building relationships while supporting and serving the community. Justin offers life insurance options designed to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Ice, check. Blades, check. Sequins, check. The Central Illinois Figure Skating Club is getting ready to mount its spring show this coming weekend. But the prospect of more ice coming to the Twin Cities has organizers thinking even further into the future. Laura Kennedy has more in this edition of the GLT Datebook.
The Central Illinois Figure Skating Club presents its spring show on Saturday, June 10th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Pepsi Ice Center. Lena Chowdhury and Susan Hennis are with the Central Illinois Figure Skating Club, and Chowdhury says the theme for this year's show is something very special. It's, oh, the games we play.
Because everybody now plays games on their phones, on their computer all the time. So it ended up happening that they have chosen to have this as a storyline, and we'll have four quarters, and each coach has one quarter, and starts with Candyland.
Of course, because all kids play Candyland
yes.
when they're little.
And then goes to Monopoly.
Okay, great, for all the budding capitalists.
And then Mario Brothers.
Of course.
You can't have a game theme show without having the Super Mario Brothers.
Absolutely.
And then it follows us with some of the app games, like Candy Crush. And then we have
Angry Birds,
great.
And pinball and Pac-Man.
So you're covering games from board games to electronic mm-hmm. games that we find so fun. And I love this new format. Susan, this is very interesting, the fact that you guys have chosen, instead of just like an individual thing where a couple of people or one person or even a group of like five-year-olds comes out and does something, there's this overarching theme. How are the children reacting to doing that?
The skaters seem to really enjoy it. There's a lot more interaction between each of the parts. You know, sometimes somebody will be coming in, weaving in through another person's, you know, solo or type of thing and weaving out. So it's definitely far more interactive than it has been in the past.
And Lena, I mean, when we think of figure skating, we mostly think of it as an individual type sport, but this takes it more into the team realm.
Yes, it is. And it's more like a storyline, a story being told, like for Candyland. And the story is we have Lord Licorice. We have a mother, Peanut Brittle. And we have
Lollipop.
Princess Lolly. So those are the characters. And the characters, and there are little ones, and they're being in candy, in the candy forest. And then Princess Lolly would come in, or Lord Licorice will come in and interact with all of them. So it's more of a story being told. It will remind you of, if you go to a Disney, to watch a Disney show, it's kind of like that. they're enjoying it immensely, and they're also enjoying it opportunity to skate with the older kids, as the more accomplished skaters, as that are coming weaving in and out with them and skating with them, and have all of those interactions. I think that's the part they're enjoying the most.
We have lots of different levels of accomplishment with these skaters. Some of them are just learning to skate, and everybody loves that. And then we have older skaters like your daughter, Maisha, as well. What role is she playing in this?
She is Mario.
Oh, so does she wear a brush mustache?
No, she's not wearing a mustache, but she's going to have something fun planned with the mustache in our program.
Okay. Lena, you also have a guest artist who'll be coming to perform.
Sasha Lunin is our guest skater. He is U.S. National Junior Men's Fifth. He is a fabulous skater, and he is skating to two routines. And the first one is a Michael Jackson routine. He's ending the show with "I'm Bad to the Bone."
Oh, Bad to the Bone, George Thorogood.
Yes,
and the Destroyers.
He is such a performer. It is going to be a treat to see him.
Is it good for the young skaters to meet somebody who's had some success, and how that impacts them?
Definitely. I mean, I will say my daughter's only 8. Things like this are a huge treat for her, just to see somebody so accomplished and still being young and just kind of understanding the focus and the dedication that it takes to do that.
Now, of course, the parents will be coming to watch their children perform. But this isn't just something for the parents. This is something you want the whole community at. This is a chance for the community to get to know the Central Illinois Figure Skating Club.
And it is a very fun event for a whole family to come. Bring your kids, bring your grandkids, and come to the show, because it is fun for everybody, and it's our prices for tickets are very reasonable. I can guarantee that people, if they come to watch it, they are going to really, really enjoy it.
Well, I'm going to go a little bit off topic here and ask what you think about something. It was in the news recently about a possible new West Side sports complex going up, which could include an ice rink. What do you guys think about that?
We are actually talking about it. It's me being part of the skating community. We're going to have a couple of meetings in end of this month to explore that possibility. We are actually very much in support of if we could get that sports complex built and have an ice rink in it, because the demand is so high for ice. It's constant. And I don't even know how our manager, Michael Hornbord, I don't know how he manages to schedule ice and to make everybody somewhat happy. Nobody has the amount of ice that we need to have.
Because you have hockey players and you have figure skaters. You know, everybody's competing for ice. Perhaps having another ice rink in town will take the pressure off the Pepsi Ice Center.
Yes, it will. And we very much need it, because our community has grown and the demand for ice has grown. So we do need that. We do need that really badly.
I agree. It's hard to find ice, and we're always searching for times that meet the scheduling needs, especially when you have kids that are in school, and every group wants that time right after school. You know, hockey wants it, figure skating wants it, so.
So it could be a real step in the right direction.
Yes,
for you guys.
Yes, it is. Oh, we are 100% in support of it, and whatever we can do to get that going, we are willing to do it.
That's Lena Chowdhury and Susan Hennis of the Central Illinois Figure Skating Club. Their spring show is Saturday, June 10th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Pepsi Ice Center in Bloomington. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can get ticket information for the ice show at the Facebook page of the Central Illinois Figure Skating Club. It's Sound Ideas, and this is the Cactus Blossoms. When Jenny Lewis plays the Castle Theater in Bloomington tonight, her opening act is a couple of 30-something brothers with a sound that harkens back to 1940s and 50s classic country. The Minneapolis brothers, Paige Burkham and Jack Torrey, are collectively known as the Cactus Blossoms. They spoke with GLT's John Norton via Skype about their latest album. Torrey said they sort of stumbled onto classic country.
Combination of people we met around town, libraries, and thrift stores, probably.
Yeah.
I mean, we like all sorts of music. How we got started playing country music, we were playing shows where we'd play like 50 songs during our three sets or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And so we were just learning all kinds of of old country songs we thought were good, and that launched us even further into that world.
Beside me, are you running? Are you falling? Is an old love calling your name? Your
What's the appeal of that sound? I mean, you guys didn't grow up probably listening to classic country. What appeals to you?
There's different things that I think are appealing about it. You know, like some of the heartbreak songs, the first time someone hears those in a way that they can connect with them, they realize, you know, how powerful an old country song can be. I don't even know. What do you think, Paige?
I think also just the sound of the instruments, you know, like the way things were recorded. So this could go for any, you know, other kinds of music recorded maybe between the 1940s to through the 60s. You know, pretty much all the bands were playing live. Their instruments sound really good. The singers all sang really well. And it's just kind of its own, you know, whether it was soul music or country music or rock and roll from that time, I think something we were attracted to is the musicianship and the sounds of the instruments, I think, like the steel guitar. And once we started finding some of that old country music, I think we got kind of sucked into some of those sounds.
She's a honeybee looking for nectar. She's a clown collector. She's a lover who'll meet and protect her. She's a clown collector. Take a look at me, man. All to know.
Well, can I ask you about some of the songs on the album? Do you mind?
Yes, sure.
Stoplight Kisses, it's a fun song that kind of sounds like it's straight out of the 50s. Who gets credit for the actual term, Stoplight Kisses?
I wrote that one.
Is that Jack? Jack?
Yeah.
Okay.
I wrote that. That's one of the probably the oldest songs that's on the record. I wrote that quite a few years ago, so maybe that's why it sounds kind of vintage.
Well, you're not that old. Well, and actually, the phrase itself has sort of a nostalgic, almost naive sound to it. Stoplight Kisses sounds like something that might have been a phrase in the 1950s, you know?
Yeah, well, it's kind of a dirty song all dressed up to sound clean.
Okay, all right.
Stoplight Kisses, what I want from you. Stoplight Kisses, all I wanna do. When I pull to the crosswalk, eastbound small talk, you know what's on my mind. I loosened up my seatbelt, made feel the heart fail. Kissing time till the don't walk side.
You guys get compared a lot with other brothers, the Everly Brothers, the Lubin Brothers. But I want to ask you about another song, Queen of Them All. In that song, I hear Hank Williams, Sr. Are you guys unabashed Hank Williams fans, or did you get to really dig into him as well?
Yeah, I learned a bunch of his songs years ago. I mean, he was one of the first country people I had heard. And of course, the first time when I heard him, I was like, this is not country music. This is something weirder and cooler than country music. But
really?
Sure enough, Hank is one of the fathers, but it's interesting to see where influences pop out. I'd never thought about Queen of Them All as a Hank tune, but I guess I'd love to hear him do it.
You're the queen of them all. That's what makes it easy for when you call me with your charm.
By the way, the name of the album is You're Dreaming. And J.D. McPherson produced your album. Now, he's a guy that I met a couple of years ago. He was at the Castle Theater, and we had a great chat. Nice guy. And he's got music that's a throwback, kind of like you guys. He's more rockabilly and probably 50s R&B. But, you know, you already knew him from touring, is my understanding?
Yeah, well, he came through Minneapolis and played a show here. That was the first time we met him, was when we opened for him at First Avenue here in Minneapolis. Then we ran into him at some other festivals and kind of got to know him over the next few months after that. And then yeah, he told us he was interested in working with us and helping us with the record. So that was a good twist of fate for us. We loved working with him, and he is one of the nicest guys out there.
Yeah, he is, isn't he? Well, and it's one thing to get to know somebody out on tour, but another when they're producing, you know, your album, your music, they're shaping your music. Did you click right away in the studio as well?
Yeah. You know, that you had mentioned Queen of Them All. Yeah. I remember, I think that was the first song we recorded when we went down to Chicago to do our record. And so I think that we were only in the studio for a couple hours and had just kind of, we didn't even know JD that well at that point, and had just met the other players on the album, and it was happening right away. We worked together a lot. We were on the same page a lot as far as how we wanted to do things. So there wasn't a lot of arguing or, you know, big decision making. It was all pretty smooth and organic. And, you know, because you don't want people to lose their minds when they're trying to be comfortable and in a safe place and doing a song for the first time ever. So it was really cool to have him there as moral support, but also, you know, his music ideas and just having his ears pinpointing things that he thought were cool or could get better was really, really fun and valuable.
Sure. You mentioned Queen of Them All. Can you point to another song on the album maybe where you guys worked together and it came out maybe even better than you originally thought?
One fun thing is the one cover tune we did on the record was originally by these guys, Alton and Jimmy. JD played us that song and said, you know, I think this will be perfect for you guys. You know, let's try it.
And I think that's the one song that you hear JD playing a little electric guitar on too.
Cactus Blossoms, Paige Burkham and Jack Torrey, continued good luck to you, and I hope we bump into each other down the road.
All right, sounds good. Thanks, John.
No More Crying the Blues from the Cactus Blossoms album, You're Dreaming. Brothers Paige Burkham and Jack Torrey spoke via Skype with GLT's John Norton. The Cactus Blossoms play the Castle Theater in Bloomington tonight, opening for Jenny Lewis. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Find John Norton's interview at WGLT.org. Find all the individual stories and the complete show podcast at WGLT.org and at iTunes. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas. Share your thoughts at Facebook.com/WGLTFM. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.